It's sometimes, especially entrepreneurs, especially as they get successful, they want to do the job that they want to do, not the job that needs to actually get done. And so sometimes you're a technology entrepreneur and you got to build a sales team and your job is to actually go do that.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Marcus Aurelius: "A man's worth is no greater than his ambitions." My guest today, Corey Thomas, has followed his ambition to the top of the corporate world. He is the CEO and chairman of Rapid7, a leading public cybersecurity software company valued at around $3.5 billion. He's also an active angel investor in several tech companies, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a director and deputy chair of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and a member of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts Board of Directors, among other honors. Before Rapid7, Corey worked extensively at companies such as Microsoft, Deloitte, and AT&T. Corey, welcome. It's great to have you join us on the Elevate Podcast.
Bob, it's great to be here with you today. Thank you so much for having me.
So we've worked together for years on the Billboard. However, digging your background, you are quite the definition of a Renaissance man with varied degrees of interest and activities.
You could say I'm an overscheduled man more than anything else. I don't know how much Renaissance goes into being overscheduled.
There's a lot in your bio to dig into, but I am always curious, like, what was childhood like for you? Were you naturally, where'd you grow up? Were you interested in tons of different things? Did you start in one direction and go another way?
You know, my childhood was relatively simplistic. And so, look, I grew up in a very good, a working class family. My father was a security guard, a self-taught electrician, a janitor. He did whatever it takes to make the bills paid. My mom started off as a secretary, and then she became a human resources professional. She went to school much, much later in life. But things were pretty simplistic. Like, if you grow up sort of like working class, you know, they just like, you need to study hard, go to school, and sort of like do better. So my aspirations throughout, until I was in the ninth grade, was to like just get some professional job or be a contractor. But it was a bunch of different things. But if I could just actually like have a job, that was the ambition. And if I could make $50,000 a year, that would have been amazing at that time frame. And what happened was I ended up getting bused to school and switching schools for a number of different reasons in the ninth grade. And when I went to a new school in the 10th grade, their attitude was foundationally different. They're just like, all right, what are you going to do with your life? And no, all of our students actually do great things with their life. So you need to pick something compelling. And that started this shift from like, no, I showed them like this cool state school that I wanted to go to. That was not even a state school, it was a small school. And they said, nope, all of our students only go to top 30 schools. So like, come back to us when you're going to do it. And it was just a different mentality then. But so like, I evolved over time. And that's sort of like been my mindset. Like, I'm always trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up.
Was that a private school or was it a charter school?
No, it was a public magnet school. Yeah, it was a public magnet school, but it was a test in school. You had to test into the school.
Right. But there's a lot of data, and I've seen studies on just the value of raising expectations for kids. And it sounds like that's what the environment was.
No, that's what it was. And I was a firsthand example of pushing and saying like, no, you're actually going to do something different. So I had that school and I got bused to a wealthy part of town. Pushed the expectations. When I got to Vanderbilt, I pushed the expectations. And my first couple managers when I was at AT&T sort of like pushed me. And I just say, look, I was a kid that needed a little bit of push to be challenged in a way that actually made my mental cycles get going. It's also true, I would just say, it's not just a push, it's what you see. So the more I got exposure to successful people, the more I actually understood what was possible more.
Again, you've covered every, when I looked through, right? So you went to Vanderbilt to study engineering, then you immediately went to HBS. So you went from engineering to business.
It's kind of an important one. I would just say like one of the things that you see that why I may be considered all over the place today, AT&T was something I wanted to work at like for most of my childhood, because this was the old AT&T that had Bell Labs in there. And I thought Bell Labs was the coolest thing in the world because I was always like computers and stuff like that. And so when I went there to start interning in the 90s, they were like, you know, this is the period where they broke it up. They spin off Lucent. And so when I went there, you saw a company that was actually nothing like what I had read about. And so, like, it did not have this vibrancy, this innovation.
Don't Meet Your Heroes is this sort of a version of that?
Don't Meet Your Heroes. And, but what it started was a lifelong thing because it made no sense to me. I still met brilliant people there. And so it started this cycle of how do brilliant people fail and how do wildly successful companies decay? And that's more than anything, figuring out what makes a company and individual vibrant and what makes something successful and what makes it stick. That started the quest.
So after HBS, you went to Deloitte. I think that's kind of one of those coveted jobs after business school. I'm curious, what did you like there?
Yeah, so I went to Deloitte prior to business school. And it was a great, look, part of the reason I actually went there was I asked a bunch of people why sort of like companies worked or didn't work. And they're just like, well, just go be a consultant and figure it out. There's no
I don't know what a consultant is, but that sounds good. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds great. Exactly. That sounds amazing. And so I went to Deloitte. It was a great experience. I learned a ton. I got to build some interesting technology for some fascinating customers. I got to live around the world. I lived in Switzerland. I lived in London. I got to be essentially the glorified executive assistant to one of the top executives there. It was a massive learning time. And I actually learned a lot there. And then I went back to business school, which was its own experience. But that was the reason I went there. I was trying to figure out like what made things tick.
Got it. Yeah, and I've read that you've been focused your early career and maybe even like on the recipe for success.
Yeah, well, I started trying to figure out. I actually really believe there's a recipe for success.
Tell us what it is so we can just get right to the...
I wish there was one. Unfortunately, like, I don't think I was like... I kept hunting and then I think I was in like my 40s. I'm like, oh, darn it. There's no recipe for success. Like, you just got to keep doing the fundamentals.
But that's an engineering process approach.
Yeah, it's a growth process. You can argue that I grew too slowly. I could have realized that 10 years earlier and it's worth a little bit more.
So what was then your first role after HBS?
I went to Microsoft because one of the things, look, you have to remember, I was a technologist and a computer engineer. I grew up in the Unix world, which is a precursor to Unix. And so I was a little bit arrogant in saying like, well, Microsoft is wildly successful and they have a bunch of crappy technology. So like I can really learn how business works if I go to, you know, a company. And it turns out I went to Microsoft as a product manager, which is an overlap of marketing and a bunch of different things. And I learned a whole bunch about like how to build a customer base, how to think about a customer base, how to think about like what makes products live and thrive and what makes customers love them. It was another fantastic learning experience.
I know you went to a firm called Parallels before jumping to Rapid7 around 2008. And the founders hired you for SVP of marketing and sales. So again, this is another discipline you're taking on.
Another, yeah, exactly. So like I did my last couple of roles at Microsoft was marketing, then at Parallels I did marketing. And I did a little bit of consumer sales because, again, it was learning. Like, I took job. The one thing I'll just say is people are shocked. Just two important things. I took a pay cut when I went to Parallels, and it was like a lateral move. And the interesting thing was because I actually wanted to, I thought it was interesting. And then, likewise, when I went to Rapid7, I took another pay cut. And so, like, I got to give my wife credit because, like, she goes from, like, owning a house to living into, like, a 900-square-foot apartment. But I was driven in some ways.
Usually you don't come home with a, hey, I'm getting a pay cut speech. That's, yeah.
Exactly. And so, but I actually got to learn interesting things because I knew how to actually build products. I had started to learn how to market them well. But it's like, how do you sell? How do you distribute? How do you get them in customers' hands? How do you support them? That was part of what I wanted to learn. And the leadership team, Mike Tukin, Ben Nye, who was a venture, they all wanted to take a bet on me. They said, hey, we'll give you opportunities and you can learn it. And there was a great sales team. So I didn't start taking over sales immediately. But like it was just a great team at Rapid7 that I could actually learn from.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? 2 years ago, I bought a dual suspension mountain bike for the first time. And it pushed me to ride trails that I had never been willing to try before. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has exceptional capability that will have you seeing the possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. The Lexus GX comes with available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, best-in-class towing capacity, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. I've seen the new Lexus GX popping up all around my town, and not only does it have the capabilities to take you to new places on and off the road, but it's a great-looking car. The new Lexus GX is ready to raise the bar for you. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hey, Elevate listeners. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify is the partner you need to keep the cash register ringing for your e-commerce business. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading platforms. I advise a lot of companies in the e-commerce space, and almost all of them have migrated to Shopify. And as a buyer, what I love about buying from Shopify-enabled sites is that they already know who I am, and I don't have to create a new account or enter all my payment info. The Shop Pay service makes it faster and easier to buy, which surely helps with conversions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/elevate, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/elevate now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/elevate. Let's take a quick segue here because I've seen you talk about this. I think you have a similar passion around kids the same age and college and this perfectionism in society and the all A's and not getting anything. It just seems antithetical to learning. I was having a talk with my daughter the other day and she's talking about this class that's really hard and the teacher's difficult, but I think the learning quotient's really high. But it's very hard for this achievement-oriented generation to separate the grade and the path from the learning. And like you said, you went backwards because the learning was higher in a couple of these things.
I agree. I think, look, I can never tell what's good and what's bad. I think some of the stuff that I experienced as a child that was hard, I would never want my kid to experience. My parents were actually great, but it was just some things that were hard, mentality, different environment. The thing that was valuable was through football, basketball, through my parents' mentality, there was an idea that like struggle was valuable. And that was true in the church that we went to at the time. That was true in the sports that I actually played. But like for whatever reason, like that was the cultural mentality that growth came through struggle. And that if you struggled through it and you grew, then you learned it. What I would say is that like if you get through that, then it actually has a lot of personal value. Not everyone gets through that. And so the thing that I work with my kids on today is centering themselves not based on what other people think about them, but based on like how they're actually growing. And that's a natural tendency. I went through that phase of life too, where you really focus on what other people think. I would just say that in order to actually grow, like inevitably there's actually just no growth without struggle. And that ability to actually grow is what part of what makes life sweet.
It seems backwards because I know there's this natural thing to try to remove that. But those who struggle earlier when the stakes are lower, and sometimes they're higher earlier, but ostensibly lower in certain areas, like then when they run into these things later in life, they've seen it before. It's not a big deal. If they haven't, then it becomes catastrophic, something that's not even that difficult.
Yeah, my daughter and I talk about this. And I also look at some, like, it is incredibly important for young people to actually experience gut-wrenching failure at an early age and be supported around that. Because, like, I remember one time I was meeting, and I won't use names, but I was meeting an employee who got, I would just say, mediocre feedback and review. It was like not, and they were crushed, and I didn't understand it. And I'm just like, oh, and what happened is they'd never gotten any feedback before.
Right, right. You were the first person in their life to pull out a red pen and say, this isn't perfect, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And part of it was, I'm just like, wow, that's actually like a very privileged thing to actually sort of get validation all the time. On the other hand, I think the highest form of love is for people to be committed to seeing you as your best self without judgment. And there's a fine thing to see, like people that are committed to seeing you as your best self without judgment, meaning that when they actually are either giving feedback or sharing perspectives, they believe that you're amazing and they want to see your best self. Versus, just to be clear, there's people that are actually giving you feedback to actually see you humble. And those are just fundamentally different things.
Yeah, they're doing it for themselves, not to help you make better.
They're doing it for themselves, not for your uplifting.
People would actually be surprised to know that there's pretty definitive research that on the best model of parenting. Like, it's not actually debate, that it is high challenge and high support. And if you have the challenge without the support, that's narcissistic.
Well, it's traumatic. What happens is the challenge without the support turns to trauma, which, because it doesn't get processed, you want the challenge to actually be resolved in some constructive way. And that builds the resiliency that we all need over time.
Right. But if you actually look at the outcomes, high support without challenge is probably equally as bad. It's just permissive. Yeah.
Builds fragility. And so like you build very fragile. So that's the hard thing. Look, I wish that I had a magic playbook around this, but like I'm still learning on parenting and I'm still figuring myself out. But like, I do think that constructive growth and struggle is a positive thing.
It's interesting. The leaders that I've found who are really thoughtful about leadership, I think tend to think of the crossover between parenting and leadership, right? It should be similar. Like micromanaging, and no one likes that in the workplace. Why do we think people would like it outside the workplace?
Well, you know, the other one that I actually have is I had one very smart executive one time who was just used to have, and was good most of the time, and they just had outburst. And so I said, listen, we got to part ways. And they were shocked. And the team was shocked. And for me, I didn't understand why they were shocked. And then when I said it, I realized it sounded condescending and horrible. I said, listen, I as a person, can't functionally tolerate behavior from an adult who makes lots of money that I would not tolerate from my child. And so, like, that's just not foundationally something I can actually do. And I'm just like, your outburst, your lack of self-control is something that I don't tolerate for my 10-year-old. Why would I find that acceptable in the workforce? That mentality is more normalized today because the idea of a toxic workforce is sort of like frowned upon. But it wasn't always that case. So this was sort of like a shock to some people at that time.
Right. That was completely appropriate a certain amount of years ago to scream and yell and do all that stuff. So in 2012, you became COO, yet another role you had not done before. And then ultimately, you took the company public in 2015, right? Became the CEO, no pun intended, but pretty rapid ascent there. So all these things first time, right? First time SVP of marketing.
First time everything along the way there, exactly.
And I saw you say when you took the company public, you thought that was going to sort of be maybe your swan song and you were going to go do your own thing.
So actually, it wasn't when I took it public. Because look, when you take a company public, you're making a long-term commitment. When I joined Rapid7, the partners at Bain at the time, and I still have a good relationship with them. What we talked about was me helping the company for a few years and then going to start my own thing. I said, listen, I'll put my own money in. I'd like you to put your own money in. And so I was actually looking to start my own company. And then I was asked to take increased responsibilities and eventually become CEO. And then even when I became CEO, I'm just like, I don't know if I'm going to do a good job. Let's figure this thing out. And the truth be told.
You kept trying to fire yourself. Yeah.
No. Like, it was about 9 months in, I probably deserved to be fired. Because like, I was making changes too fast. Again, I was a new CEO. Like, my team will tell you is I have not seen something that needed to be addressed and was not like, let's go do that. Like, the thing I've had to learn as I get older is like everything in its season. Not everything that should be done now. I did not have that muscle in my body then. And so, but we settled into it.
I know you've thought a lot about, again, you have this engineering brain, even though you've played every other role, it seems like. You've thought a lot about company culture and organizational behavior. And I think you have sort of your own definition of company culture. Can you kind of share how you think about that?
Look, we can give all these things fixed awards. At the end of the day, I think about a culture as what do the people in the organization believe makes them successful? Like, what do we all believe creates success? It's not what you actually say. It's what do you believe that makes you successful and what behaviors does that generate when things are going well and what behaviors does that generate when things are going poorly. I actually think you see a culture mostly when things are going poorly for what it's actually worth. It is belief attached to behavior. And so if a company's sort of like culture is we are highly analytical and we believe that like the best ideas can come from anyone and the right person, then what you'll actually see is they value ideas, not hierarchy. And the behaviors that you'll actually see is every meeting you sit in, you'll actually see people hunting for the people with the best ideas, or they'll defer to the people, not based on where they sit in the pecking order, but based on their domain expertise and knowledge. In crisis, they become sort of a bit theoretical, but they're digging into the thought process. So what I would just say is that just like with people, there's no right culture. Like, I think culture is actually tightly tied to context. One of my beliefs about culture and leadership is that a culture is right depending on the context of actually what's happening and what mission you're on and what's trying to happen. And there's cultures I can't be successful in. There's some that I dislike. People always ask me, they're like, you say that, like, do you ever think there's an appropriate place for an authoritarian sort of like culture where it's deferred by hierarchy? I'm like, yeah, you got a crisis where you got to do
a bunch of stuff. Like a nuclear power plant? Yeah.
Exactly. Like, you got a bunch of stuff you got to do right now. You actually want sort of like clear lines, communications, and hopefully you have the right leader. And there's time for safety culture. And there's time for innovation culture. So that's my general belief on culture.
So there's a paradox in that in terms of what I heard, in that like there's some things that have to stay the same, right? Foundational beliefs, but it also sounds like it needs to adapt based on the stage and situation.
Yeah, I think you have to evolve cultures based on the mission. I think that's hard. Look, the hardest part is that not every leader is suited for every context. So I think if you take culture out, you have to say, is the leadership and the range of cultures that I bring to the table suitable for the mission and the challenge that's actually in front of us? Look, you would never, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, you would never want me to actually drive a safety culture that actually delivered 2% or 5% points improvements every year. Because, like, I like creating. I like change. I like sort of like navigating. Like, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to be like, well, how can we actually take this and sort of like expand here? Like, that's just where I'm centered. Like, that's not the right thing for me. You know, if you want a real world example about like culture and context, one of the ones I look at, I always look at history, like take Lyndon Johnson. Was he a great leader or a poor leader? Well, if you look at how he actually navigated the politics of the civil rights thing, you could say he was extraordinary. If you look at what he did with the Vietnam War, he was horrible. Same person, again, domestic politics, exceptional at actually how do you actually get votes. Probably one of the best leaders in history about like how do you actually like get votes and vote counting. When you talk about sort of like how you actually treat a geopolitical dynamic, he was horrible. And I think that that's the different. Sometimes leaders are in the same moment and they have very different needs.
With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com. I always say a little bit to like universities, right? They have very different value propositions, right? You might have a big, like large city institution that has a value prop, and then a rural campus, and people at one school probably won't like the other. They both can be great cultures, but their value proposition is fundamentally different.
It's different. It's not right or wrong. It's suitability for you, what you need, what the time is.
And there's too much, I agree with you, in leadership, there's too much absolute good and absolute bad. I mean, one of the examples I think as soon as you said that was Andrew Cuomo, right? When COVID broke out, everyone in the world watching his newscast, excellent communication, clear, like great. And then that doesn't excuse what came after that and everything he deserved that happened to him, like two totally different scenarios.
Two totally different things. One of the things I think successful people have to watch out for, and luckily I'm married to a minister and I have a family that's very good at actually reminding me of my watch outs, is that it's easy when you're successful in one domain to think you're successful in every domain. So you extrapolate your success. And so this is why you see people commenting about stuff they actually know nothing about. Like my wife generally reminds me, she's just like, you should just reflect on whether you actually have actually any real knowledge or depth of experience on this topic that someone asked about.
Social media exacerbates this, right? You have a million followers because you do makeup, and then suddenly you're a vaccine expert. I've actually thought that they should, Facebook in a maybe dystopian way or whatever, should put some context to your credibility score. Like, you know, Corey's got a million followers, but he's known for this.
Exactly. Because it's just like, I get asked all the time as an example. I have opinions as a parent, but I get asked all the time about education and education system. I actually have no expertise in education. Now, what I have expertise on is I can actually talk about my personal experience. I can talk about as a parent, and then I can talk about from a workforce perspective about what I need. I think we have to be aware.
But you could sound authoritative if you wanted to, but you wouldn't. Yeah,
I could. Like, it would be sort of like a bit inappropriate in some ways.
So I saw you say you're looking, I like this quote, you're looking for people with high accountability, but a low need to control exactly how they deliver on the commitment to their team.
Yeah. So look, I think one of the, I always think about like, what are the healthy tensions that you need in the world? So this is one of those tensions. Is lots of people are only willing to actually accept accountability and responsibility and ownership as if they have control. And it turns out that that's an inherent weakness because you actually take away the power of the team dynamic. And I'll give you, one of my friends gave me a great example of that. The key that you really want to have in lots of ways is people that have a sense of ownership and accountability, but they don't feel the need for that accountability to come with actually sort of like excluding, filtering, and limiting the power and the impact of the team. And that's where you actually get that sweet spot. One of my friends, Sargalja, who stars on Broadway, did Moulin Rouge, Fell, and a couple other things. We were having this conversation and he talked about, yeah, he's like, hey, Corey, that's how we actually get shows like Broadway and other places. He was just like, if you come in and you're maniacal about your ideas, it's only you. He's just like, you have to have strong ideas, but you have to hold them gently so that other people can enhance those ideas and those concepts. He's like, that's what creates the magic around things. It was a powerful concept.
It's interesting. It also means inherently being comfortable, being responsible for all the things that you don't control rather than rolling everything up to you and having a 14-person management team and all that stuff.
Well, that is one of the hardest concepts that I face in leaders is just that they want the accountability to come with sort of like big orgs, and that's just not a practical, feasible, or reasonable, or helpful thing in most cases.
So talk about grabbing a shovel.
Oh, grabbing a shovel is, I think it's in some ways, it's the test that you actually give yourself. More than anything, you could say you give it to others every single day and say, are you still connected? And do you actually still have what it takes to actually truly lead? There's sometimes moments and times where people treat leadership as a philosophical sort of like thing. And what you have to be willing to do is you have to be willing to dig in as appropriate and sort of like be in it and be in the details, be in the weeds. Now, that does not mean micromanagement. That does not mean doing other people's jobs. But like you can tell when leaders are disconnected. And there's always somewhere where a leader should be deeply connected to what's going on. If at no other place, then basically if the team is operating at peak capacity and everything's fine, then they should actually be digging in two areas. They should be digging into basically constituents or customers or affiliates or partners and digging in what's happening, what's going on, showing the interest to sort of like being out there. And they should be digging into the team development, really digging into sort of like not just sort of like their team, but like what's the development capacity?
Right. Bench building.
But there's always a place to dig in. And so if a leader is a little bit too distant and they're actually spending their time, I would just say at the high level, and they're not dug in somewhere, then that's a sign of sort of like on the outward trajectory of relevance. And I always think about like leadership is, are you relevant or not?
Yeah, it's a good point. Some of the best leaders I've seen, they seem to have this good ability to fly over, right? But you have to take those deep dives, right? Either things that they're intellectually curious about, things that are broken, things that kind of need their expertise, and get down and dirty at that sort of peer level, right?
Exactly. Look, you could say whether it's situational management or crisis response or like, there's a whole bunch of different ways you can actually look at it. But the only point is that like, if there's issues, if everything's great, that's different. You can just focus on the customer and then you're still digging in. But when things are not going well, leaders have to resist the urge to actually micromanage. But I think what happens is, especially with young leaders, they perceive that. And what happens is the result is they are disconnected. And when things are not going well, it's important that you actually be personally connected, understand as you actually don't try to control it. I think the mistake is that in my engagement requires control. My engagement requires engagement, and that actually makes everything better.
Which is, you've seen the best salespeople, they ask the right questions.
That's engagement. Sort of like, I have to go in and solve it, or I have to be directive. But like, I had one yesterday, is we were going through a thing, and I was in it, but I was in it for two things. One, it sounds like what we're trying to solve is not clear. You all have to come back and actually be very clear about how you frame the problem, what you're trying to solve. And it sounds like we're not clear who owns this. all right, you have to decide who owns this. That was my job. My job wasn't to solve it, but like my job was to actually help figure out what was the bottleneck of the issue.
Yeah, help orchestrate it, coordinate it. I know people hate sports analogies. Sorry, 50%. You can guess which 50% sometimes. But I think from a leadership standpoint, they're so instructive. And the one that someone pointed out to me once, and I think it's just a great model, is coaching, like versus leading. A coach can never step onto the court. They cannot cross the line. Either they'd be thrown out or something. And if leaders accepted that sort of same threshold of like, look, I can call timeout. We could talk about this, but I can't take the ball and go shoot it instead of the other player.
That's exactly it. And that's the example what you asked about earlier is accountability without complete control.
I'm curious to pivot to cybersecurity, what Rapid7 does. Obviously, it's a huge field. Talk a little bit about who are your customers? What part of the industry do you serve?
So we serve primarily, I would say, mid to very large enterprises. We have 11,000 customers around the world. And we serve the specific group of customers called Security Operations Center. And they are responsible for looking at their attack surface or all the technology they have, seeing where it's risky, vulnerable, exploitable, reducing that exposure or that exploitability surface that allows them to be compromised, and then monitoring for attacks. So our goal is we provide technology that allows people to detect attacks quickly when they actually happen and make sure that they're mitigated or shut down. That's the technology that we actually provide, is that ability to assess, detect, and respond to emergent attacks in the environment.
So do you protect against like a lot of the ransomware stuff that we're seeing in municipalities and those sort of things? Yeah.
So, we do have some technology to protect against it. Mostly what our technology does is analytical technology. So our technology analyzes and says, here's where you're susceptible to technology and here's how you actually change your configuration to make you less susceptible.
So it's before an actual threat.
It's before and after. So we go through and we map out the environment. We say, these are your attack vectors. Here's what you can do to change them. We can automate changes for you in that environment. And then we actually then monitor that environment to say we're actually seeing active attacks. And then we enable that team to actually respond and mitigate. But we're monitoring. We're the alarm system for the technology environment.
So it's always been a little bit of a cat and mouse game, right? But I have to imagine AI has just turbocharged the good and the bad on this.
AI is a foundational technology. Unfortunately, all of us have access to. I'm excited about it. It enables a lot of positive things.
And so are the criminals. Yeah.
So like that's the thing. So like it has not changed the status quo yet.
Has it changed the pace of what you're doing or how fast the game's being played?
No, I don't think so. I think that, well, you could argue in a tight time frame, yes. But if you actually zoom out, you've had these moments where sort of like new attack vectors come out and like you see a rash of compromises and other stuff. And then you had like places where defense accelerates and you actually have accelerated sort of like defense. So I would say that like if you actually zoom out, the question is, do we keep good balance in that ecosystem? But we have to, like, you know, like if defenders do not adopt the technologies to keep pace with attackers, then they get behind. And so it's possible to actually stay ahead. I think some of us were hoping that some of the AI and automation and machine learning advances would allow us to actually accelerate ahead. And it turns out they're generally available to everybody.
So then I'm curious, you see this, we'll talk about it, but you do some investing. You obviously have the organization. When you look at all the AI, and are you in the, it's properly hyped, overhyped, underhyped? What's your thought on, does it just become a baseline expectation and everything?
I think it's poorly understood, but properly hyped. Like what it means. So when you have prior versions of technology that were more based on like machine learning, it was hard to actually for your average user to actually understand and actually see the realized value of what was actually happening. I think what large language models have actually sort of like introduced is the democratization of that value. And the reason that I think it's appropriately hyped, if you go back over a 20, 30 year arc, very few of the technology revolutions that we've had have actually generated, I would say, if you just want to take it out from a GDP perspective, actual productivity value in the overall economy.
You're saying social media hasn't created GDP value?
Exactly. But just actual productivity, like things that actually drive productivity. And so you could argue that like when virtualization came out, it actually changed the cost curve there. But like if you think about big data, well, like how did big data actually make companies more profitable and more efficient? And there's a lot of questions that actually happen there. The benefit and why I say it's not overhyped is that we're already experiencing lots of use cases where large language models specifically are driving increased productivity, and people could really feel it and see it and realize it. So I actually think that's appropriately hyped, that potential for the productivity gain, the potential for ease of use. There's a lot of potential there. I think what's overhyped right now, but could be appropriately hyped depending on the pace of technology, I think people don't understand that it's a prediction system. And it's the best prediction system that we've seen in a lot, but it's predicting the outcome of how you frame it matters. So I think people don't actually understand the underpinnings of the technology.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise. In addition to your CEO and chairman role, you also do some angel investing. Do you invest in the spaces that you know? Are you a jockey or a horse? I'm guessing you have some rubric for what makes a good investment for you.
When I was a student at Harvard Business School, Warren Buffett came in to actually speak. Like, he said something that was important that I remember to say. He's just like, if you don't understand it, don't invest in it. The thing that was actually interesting, we all say that, he talked about technology and why he had lagged periods of thing. He's just like, I just don't understand it. And I don't feel bad about the fact that my performance lags. I'm trying to figure out how to understand it. But he's just like, don't feel guilt about actually doing things that you don't understand. Understand them, and when you understand them, do them. And that was great. So when I do angel investment, it's only enterprise software. And I have to understand it. I do occasionally some things that are invested in talent because I want to see the talent thrive. So in diversifying technology for like women and people of color, I've made some small limited investments there when I have time and capacity. But by and large, it's enterprise software because that's the domain that I understand. The other thing that I have to have is time. And I don't always have time. Like, I don't have time right now. So I'm not doing active investments right now because I don't have time.
So you're involved when you do it.
I'm involved because like I'm investing because there's plenty of ways to make money. I'm investing because I'm interested. Like, it's a learning thing. Like, it's interesting. The other thing is that like in order to make the investments, you got to be able to do diligence. I do tend to partner with different venture funds and own that because I don't have the capacity to do diligence.
How important do you think it is? Like, I feel like the plan's often not the plans. How important are the people you invest in that they're adaptable and willing to sort of change as the conditions change?
Oh, I think that's hugely important. It's not just conditions. I would say it's not less good.
Yeah. Or as things prove out or don't prove out, right? Yeah.
The conversation that I actually have with every CEO, I say one is that, and this is attention. I want a CEO who actually has conviction about what they're doing. They're excited and they actually want to put all the chips on the table because they actually believe. So that's one thing. The tension is, I don't want them blind. I want them hungry and curious and interested in customer feedback and what's happening, what competitors are doing. And that's the thing, conviction and curiosity.
You like these yin and yangs, I'm noticing. Yeah.
Exactly. Those are too hard. But that's what great leaders hold tension well. And so conviction and curiosity is what we look for. The last one that I look, like I have this rubric that says conviction, curiosity, humility. The humility is, I tell every CEO I work with, I said, look, the only thing I talk to you is that like you always have to be willing to do the job that needs to be done, not the job that you want to do.
That's the milkshake case study. Clayton Christensen, what was the job of a milkshake? Have you ever read that?
Oh, no, I haven't read that one.
Oh, it's fascinating. Yeah, here's the thing. What's the job to be done? And they studied like how to market a milkshake because it kept people comfortable. Like, it was a very interesting case study. Yeah.
It's sometimes, especially entrepreneurs, especially as they get successful, they want to do the job that they want to do, not the job that needs to actually get done. And so sometimes you're a technology entrepreneur and you got to build a sales team and your job is to actually go do that. And so I always tell people that like, you got to understand what's the job that needs to get done that only you can actually do. And you got to be willing to do that job. So those are the three things that I always think about when I'm working with entrepreneurs.
The conviction and curiosity sounds like, I like when people say I have strong opinions loosely held. I think that's all. Yeah. So people heard in the bio, you have quite a lot on your plate these days between career, investing, board. I know last February, President Biden announced his intent to appoint you as one of 14 members on the National Security Council. How do you manage your time, or how do you make decisions how to allocate your time amongst so many different things?
Yeah, so one, it was a huge honor. It was the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee, which advised on a whole bunch of things about technology and security. I work with my assistant every year to say, like, where's the time
going to come from? Yeah.
No, so there's where we're going to allocate or rotate our time. And so based on what's needed. So one, I have a job and family. I have like rapid time in my family. That's the dominant thing. That's the need. They do get benefit from me actually spending time outside of there because it's the growth and learning. So like part of what I'm always looking at is time outside of my job and my family needs to actually be both growth and contribution. I need to be contributing and growing at the same time. Otherwise, I should just be donating like to it, but I shouldn't actually be doing it. So it has to actually fit an interest area. So for my job, it became a geopolitical issue too. And as we were actually doing it, so understanding what's happening around the world and what's happening. So the Council on Foreign Relations and the NSTAC were sort of the growth areas for me, but also helped me. I was genuinely interested. I got to learn a lot and I got to contribute back to my country that I love. And so like that was an opportunity to actually contribute and grow. So that was the big thing. The Federal Reserve System, where I'm the chair of the Boston, it's always been an opportunity to learn and so understand the economy. We sit down and we actually are saying like what's necessary, what's growth, and where's the intersection of growth and contribution to country, society, city. But like, and that's where I spend. So like the Federal Reserve and the Presidential NSTAC, those are contribution and growth. So that's the sweet spot of that.
Awesome. So have you thought about writing a book? You have all of these fascinating stuff that you've done. Have you thought about putting that all together?
My chief of staff, Grace, is very talented, tries to prop me to actually for us to sit down and do one periodically. And then after she actually goes through the exercise I just talked about where do we want to spend our time now, she's just like, yeah, let's hold that discussion to next year. She's just like the, because also I got to spend a lot of time with customers, partners, and stuff like that. So it'll be something I do at some point in time. And in fact, I think Grace was just, she's like, we got to start making more notes. Luckily, I do a lot of speaking.
You just have AI find everything you ever said, right? And
exactly. Like there's a lot of speaking and writing and other stuff, but I think that's an area that we're focused on.
There is something you identified yourself, resonated with me, I'm sure other people have too, but a slow burn introvert. What does that mean, especially for someone who's a CEO, who is out there talking to people at board roles? Like, I think there are a lot of people who perceive that people are extroverted because they have to play that role, but they're not.
Yeah, so I think you're asking, and apologies for that. What does it mean to be a slow burn introvert? So technically, I'm on the borderline of the Myers-Briggs thing. But at the end of the day, the way to think about it is I actually do not get energy from others. I get energy from actually taking walks, reading books, like in my own, like being in my head, in my space. That's how I recharge and refresh. I have a large pool of energy and it's a slow drain. Some people, like being around people is a slow drain. It's not as a fast drain. Like they just burn the energy down fast. For me, it's a slow drain. And so like I have lots of capacity to be around people. But if I am all day around and then it's the cocktail parties and stuff like that, like that it's draining down and it hits. So I have to be able to recharge time in there at different points in time.
And for you, that's just quiet or outdoors or reading or.
I love to. And by the way, I do get recharged in very, very small groups. Taking hikes with my daughter, doing something with myself, I do find that recharging, or with a friend. It's just very small groups. And I actually love being outdoors. The hikes, activities, sports, like all of that, I find recharging.
All right, last question for you. This is multivariant. It can be singular or repeated or personal or professional. But what's a mistake that you've made that you've learned the most from?
Oh, a mistake. There's so many over the years. I would just go to, so like, I think one of the biggest mistakes I actually made over long, and I actually got corrected on it, and it changed a little bit of it. And it was the idea that doing things fast was a way to actually make you successful. So like I used to sort of be focused on like how fast things happen, how fast did I actually get promoted, how fast did I actually do that. And one of my mentors pointed out that when you're young, the stacking up of the accomplishments, while it may matter, but they gave me this visual. They said you're robbing yourself of the depth that's needed to sustain any success you actually have. And so the feedback that they gave me, they said, like, if you think about the depth, it was how rich are your relationships? How deep is your understanding and your foundational sort of like knowledge of it? And so it was long-term building a deep reservoir was actually better overall than the speed of how fast you move from one thing to another. And that shift actually, I think, has changed the quality of the life and the opportunity for me to have impact.
That's an important one. So, Corey, how can people learn more about you and your work at Rapid7? Where should they go?
Oh, well, for my work, I'm always happy to talk about the work that we're doing in cybersecurity. You can go to our website, www.rapid7.com. And on there, too, we have lots of my talks and speeches and other stuff on the site.
Awesome. Well, Corey, thanks for joining us today and sharing your story with our listeners. You have incredible story, incredible background, and I don't know how you have enough hours in the day.
Well, that's a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored.
To our listeners, thanks for tuning in to the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Corey and Rapid7 on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to follow the show to be notified about new episodes and have them downloaded right in your podcast app to listen. Thanks again for your support. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.